Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Irina Zhurov.
And I'm Bob Beck. For 40 years, the U.S. has banned the export of mostly all crude oil. Matt Laszlo reports a new debate is raging in Washington over whether to end the ban.
The U.S. banned crude oil exports after the oil embargo of 1973. It's been in place since, which has negatively impacted global oil prices. Wyoming Republican Senator John Barrasso says he's ready to lift the ban.
Well, I'm supportive of exporting American energy, exploring for more American energy, but we're exporting coal from Wyoming. We want to export more natural gas and as well as additional petroleum products.
Barrasso says the ban on crude oil exports is hurting the U.S. during this modern-day energy boom.
That means producing more, and obviously if we're selling that abroad, that helps us as a nation with our balance of payments, and we wouldn't be sending hundreds of billions of dollars overseas.
Others in Wyoming aren't sold on the idea of lifting the crude oil export ban. Among them, Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis.
I am an advocate, quite frankly, for natural gas exports because we have such a tremendous glut of natural gas and the price is so low that it discourages exploration.
Lummis says it's a different picture with crude oil because the U.S. still imports more than 40% of its oil from overseas, often from countries with a volatile political and military landscape.
We all know that we're still importing oil from other countries. We also know that we have natural gas wells shut in because of the glut in natural gas. So as I look at it, I am much more concerned about trying to stimulate the price of natural gas while providing export opportunities for the natural gas community.
As for the impact on Wyoming producers if the ban is lifted, Bruce Hinchey, the president of the Petroleum Association of Wyoming, says states like Texas, Louisiana, and Alaska stand to gain the most.
You know, we're not close to any ports, so to export, it's going to have to go a long way to export and there's other crude closer to ports to export than us.
Academics largely agree. Tim Considine is a professor of energy economics at the University of Wyoming.
Well, it's mixed bag. For Wyoming oil producers, prices could be higher. And for refiners, their feed costs, their crude and liquids, would be a bit more expensive.
But Considine says overall it will help spur economic growth.
You're allowing markets to sort all this out, and free trade, everyone benefits from free trade in the end when it's all said and done. There'll be winners and losers, but for net, it's a win for the U.S. economy.
The million, or more accurately, billion-dollar question is what will this mean for you when you fill up your gas tank? Charles Mason is a petroleum professor at the University of Wyoming. He says consumers may be the losers as gas prices go up.
You can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs.
But Mason says the price increase he's predicting will merely get lost in the background noise.
So if I'm right and crude oil goes up a little but not a lot, maybe $5, you probably see something like a 15-cent increase in the price of gas.
While the debate over ending the export ban on crude oil continues to pit some Republicans against other Republicans, they're still unified in one thing, opposing the Obama administration. Senator Barrasso says administration officials are hampering the U.S. energy economy.
I think we have such incredible resources in the United States, and we're being held back by the Obama administration policies from really exploring for additional sources of energy that we know are there. And we ought to be doing that. It would help our economy. It would help with jobs. The taxes on the energy being sold overseas would help at home.
And Congresswoman Lummis says while the debate over the export ban has popped up in policy circles, she isn't really hearing about it from energy producers and refiners back home.
Now, their main concern legislatively is that, quite frankly, that tax reform might change the way that they can recover their costs of production. I hear frequently about regulations that are stifling their ability to produce oil and gas.
Efforts to unwind regulations and to overhaul the tax code remain stalled in this hyperpartisan Congress. But the debate over the crude oil ban is now bubbling here in Washington. While experts say it's unlikely to be ended anytime soon, it's become the talk of this town. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When energy development happens on public lands, companies have to reclaim the land. That means restoring the landscape after it's been disturbed. But exactly what's required varies from one part of the state to another. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports that agencies are making those rules more consistent in hopes of helping keep sage-grouse off the endangered species list.
I'm standing in an open plot of land in Laramie with Calvin Strom. He works at the Wyoming Reclamation and Restoration Center, and he says they started trying to reclaim this site several years ago.
I seeded it in the fall of 2011, but we haven't got anything to grow yet.
Well, nothing except weeds. This site is a demo site, a place for researchers and students at the University of Wyoming to learn about reclamation. But Center Director Pete Stahl says the problems they've run into here are the same problems that energy companies frequently encounter when they try to reclaim land after drilling.
There's areas of the state of Wyoming that have a growing season the same as places in the Arctic Circle.
But there's a bigger issue. Oil and gas reclamation requirements are not consistent across the state.
Even a good definition of what is adequate reclamation, something as basic as that, is still up in the air a bit.
The Bureau of Land Management sets the rules for most oil and gas reclamation in Wyoming. But the BLM has a number of offices throughout the state, and those offices have differing rules for how to reclaim land that's been disturbed. Stahl says that includes how to manage the soil, what types of vegetation need to be replanted, and how to monitor to make sure that reclamation was successful.
It would be good to have more uniform revegetation requirements among the different field offices.
Where it's inconsistent, that's for a reason.
That's Mary Gamper, who's in charge of reclamation for BLM Wyoming.
We live in a very varied landscape. There is not a one-size-fits-all approach to reclamation.
Gamper says landscapes and vegetation are different across the state, so in her view, it doesn't make sense to have a blanket set of requirements for all areas. Most experts, including Stahl, agree that you have to take differing landscapes into consideration. But the inconsistencies bring problems, particularly when it comes to sage-grouse. The University of Wyoming's Jeff Beck is an ecosystem expert.
Energy development has been recently the most important factor contributing to the decline of sage-grouse. And so the reclamation of disturbed lands, like where oil and gas well pads are, could have a lot of bearing on the eventual recovery of the species.
In other words, good reclamation is important for keeping sage-grouse off the endangered species list. But Pat Dybert with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says the inconsistencies in the BLM's requirements make it hard to know if good reclamation is happening.
It makes it more difficult for us to determine whether or not that reclamation effort will be successful. And therefore, does it have conservation value to the sage-grouse?
Dybert says when they make a final decision about sage-grouse listing, they need a way to know whether reclaimed land can count as suitable sage-grouse territory. She says concerns about sage-grouse habitat being destroyed and insufficient rules to protect habitat were even part of the reason the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recommended listing the birds several years ago. The BLM's Caleb Heiner says the agency is taking those concerns to heart.
We're under an effort to have regulatory mechanisms placed into our resource management plans to support the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's listing decision for sage-grouse in 2015.
Heiner says the goal has always been to restore vegetation to its original state, but now the BLM is planning to impose more formal rules with sage-grouse in mind.
On a practical level, what I think you'll be looking at is more of a component to having the shrubs, in this case sagebrush predominantly, as well as the forbs and the grasses that the sage-grouse rely on throughout their life cycles.
BLM is creating new resource management plans in some parts of the state and amending existing plans in others. They won't necessarily create uniform reclamation rules for the whole state, but they will require that when sage-grouse territory is disturbed, it's reclaimed in such a way that it becomes suitable sage-grouse habitat again. And they'll lay out the scientific justification for reclamation inconsistencies that continue to exist. The BLM has been working closely with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to come up with the new rules, and Pat Dybert says the changes will be a major improvement. The new plans are expected to be finalized sometime this year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
When we come back, we'll have a conversation with the new dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and a story about efforts to fund early childhood education in the state. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhorov.
And I'm Bob Beck. Last summer, Paula Lutz from Montana State University was hired to replace longtime University of Wyoming Arts and Sciences Dean Oliver Walter. She joins us today on Open Spaces to share her vision for the college.
We can reach to greater heights in our research and creative activity here. There are ways of doing that that require a little bit of investment, certainly investment in faculty time and perhaps some of our resources. So a big part of my time has been looking at the budget and how we might invest in, for example, research a little bit more. We already do some fabulous things on campus in terms of teaching. I'd like to see that expanded because our college does so much of the foundation teaching here. And then, of course, there's always outreach. I don't think I mentioned our emphasis on global and international work for students and for faculty. That was had a real place in Ollie Walter's heart, my predecessor, and I certainly don't want to let that slip backwards.
I think the outreach maybe has interested some folks, but just by you mentioning that, is it a situation where you can do more degrees, more things online?
That's one of the things we're considering. I see that we have some good programs already existing, and the opportunities, when I talked to Dean Susan Fry of the Outreach School, there are a lot of opportunities. Again, it's a matter of investing and what do the people want and need and how can we better deliver that. But for example, things that we do for teachers, we're getting ready to do another class of the Masters in English, Master of Arts in English for teachers. And I've heard whispers of some other programs like that that people would like to do, and those are just a couple of examples.
Arts and Sciences Dean Paula Lutz visiting with us. A couple things I noticed you mentioned in your list of goals and priorities. One, obviously, growing enrollment. Everybody talks about that, but also maybe a target on diversity. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I come from a background in biology, so the STEM disciplines are close to me, close to my heart, and increasing the number of women and underrepresented minorities in the STEM disciplines has been something that I've worked on for a good part of my career. I hope to take up that banner here. I think we already do many things, but there's more that we might do. In terms of diversity, I come here and I find that we have several significant minority groups, our Latina population, our Native American population, certainly African American as well. And I guess the number of predominant minorities is different here in Wyoming than it has been at other universities where I've served. So it's a learning experience for me, and I think there's quite a bit that we can do in terms of urging more students from those underrepresented minorities to enter, and not just the STEM disciplines, but to come and see Wyoming as a place where diversity is valued. I think one of the ways you do that is by having a diverse faculty, so that builds on that we would want to go out and make sure that we have, that we show that we value diversity. It's one thing to say it, but if you're actually living it and people can see you value it and you're making those hires, I think that's a critical piece in recruitment of diverse students.
Maybe one last thing you touched on also when we've chatted previously about reaching out to alumni and those types of things. What are you hoping to gain from all that?
I want to hear what they have to say, how we can better serve them, what they would like us to do. It's one thing for us to sit here and say, oh, these are programs they would like, but to go out and listen and to understand the communities want more cultural opportunities. We recently took Carmina Burana on the road after it was introduced and premiered here in Laramie, and I received a note from some alums in Thermopolis who were just delighted and said it was just terrific and indeed suggested we should do more of that. I mentioned the Saturday University. I believe we can do more of that.
University of Wyoming Arts and Sciences Dean Paul, lots of pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you, Bob.
Over the years, the legislature has not been overly supportive of efforts to fund early childhood education in Wyoming, mostly because of concerns that the state could interfere with private business. But members of the Joint Education Committee hope that a new proposal can overcome those concerns. The committee has drafted a bill that will coordinate all the early childhood efforts that currently exist and provide money to improve services. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Actually, the state does provide some funding and oversight of early childhood programs, but the effort is spread out among four agencies. Last summer, lawmakers asked agencies to find a better way to coordinate things, and the Department of Education was given the task of overseeing the effort. The department's Leighton Thomas says it was an important decision.
Most of the resources are targeted right now to very specific populations. We don't have a coordinated effort around early ed for all kids so that we can identify where some efficiencies are, where the gaps are that we're not filling and not meeting needs.
Research shows that early childhood education, sometimes known as preschool education, is critical in developing learners. University of Wyoming professor Michelle Buchanan says quality programs are a must. She says if the state can make sure that preschool learning is effective and put money into the effort, it should make a difference towards improving overall learning for years to come.
If we support kids early on, their chances of being, quote, ready for school, being successful in school, are improved. And if you look at the long-term benefits, for every dollar we invest in early childhood, we get a return anywhere from $4 to $9.
State Senator Chris Rothfuss says right now many kids in the state are not entering kindergarten with the same skills.
We know that somewhere around half of the kids go to kindergarten without sufficient background and knowledge, readiness effectively for that kindergarten experience. And we need to change that.
Rothfuss, a Democrat from Laramie, is a member of the Joint Education Committee that drafted the bill to not only coordinate early childhood education services, but also fund resources for community-based preschool and daycare programs. The funding would be provided as a grant and can be used to both develop and improve existing programs. So when kids start school, they are further along.
Not trying to take over and reinvent the wheel, but trying to build effectively public-private partnerships or community-based organizations, entities that are already trying to do something and have an interest, provide some additional state funds to encourage those to be developed further.
Rothfuss says the state does not want to compete with private providers. They want to work with them. One of the best examples of this is in Thermopolis, where in 2010, Hot Springs County School District early childhood liaison Amy Reddy approached preschools and daycares and asked them to work with the school district to make sure kids were better prepared to attend school.
Kids are reading in kindergarten now. They are writing their numbers to 100 in kindergarten. All of the daycares and really a lot of the preschools were unaware of these skills these kids were having to do in kindergarten. So the school district felt like it was very important that we open up lines of communication.
Reddy remembers there was a lot of mistrust early on, but after several months, things changed. She stressed a common point.
We are not taking away preschool from the community. We are bringing resources to them.
Reddy says the results have been remarkable. Young students are achieving at a much higher level, and she's been asked to show other districts how the Hot Spring system works. State Education Director Rich Crandall says there are similar efforts now taking place all across the state, and he's excited about the development. His hope is that the legislation will lead to other advances, but he adds that there are occasional unique challenges. For example, Sweetwater County is being forced to look at a school-run preschool program.
They have 275 seniors graduating, and they have 575 kindergartners starting. But we've been working with both Rock Springs and Green River to put together a four-year-old tablet, kind of a blended learning kindergarten readiness program, because they're never going to have enough preschool space for 575 kids.
But Senator Rothfuss stresses that for the most part, it will be existing facilities that will get funding to help improve what they offer.
We're effectively trying to use our funds to improve the situation without competing in the marketplace. And again, I think we were real sensitive to that.
Rothfuss says the state wants to improve learning at all levels. He and others say this is an exciting piece of the puzzle. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Coming up, we'll hear how navigators are helping people sign up for health insurance in Jackson and about America's first expedition up Mount Everest. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Irina Zhorov.
And I'm Bob Beck. Cheyenne Regional Medical Center is heading a statewide effort called Enroll Wyoming to help people get health insurance through the new online marketplace. The program has trained navigators across the state, including in Jackson, where St. John's Medical Center and Teton County Library have teamed up to offer individualized sessions designed to guide community members through healthcare.gov. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Huntington has more.
I don't have internet service myself, and so I was concerned about how I'm going to, you know, fill out this Obamacare insurance.
Julie, who asked that only her first name be used, signed up for a session after reading about it in the local newspaper.
And then your password.
She's hunched over a laptop computer with Liz Devine and Trudy Keyworth. They're both financial navigators from St. John's Medical Center. But they're not at the hospital. For the past hour, they've been seated around a table inside a study room at Teton County Library.
Come on, little mouse.
There you go. And then it was, okay.
The hospital and library have teamed up to offer one-hour private sessions several times a week to community members who want help purchasing insurance. One in five people in Teton County do not have insurance. Even though she works full-time at a gift shop, Julie says the small business can't afford to cover its employees. She hasn't had insurance in 13 years.
I believe in the preventative measures. I try to avoid doctors as all possible because of that. But as you get older, you find out you do need the doctors a little more.
Now in her 50s and with four grandchildren, Julie says she's finding it harder and harder to avoid going to the doctor.
I got two degenerative discs in my lower back, and they want us to do an MRI.
Yeah.
Until I get insurance, I can't do it.
As Devine and Keyworth walk Julie through healthcare.gov, they hit a roadblock. So they summon librarian Kurt Plagg, who's next door in the computer lab helping another individual.
It's not letting you log in because you're still logged in.
Oh, okay.
And what you have to do is click on this set, and then it'll take you to the questions.
Oh, very good. Very good.
That's why we needed out here.
It's nerve-wracking. Because I would like to be done with this.
Plagg says that for situations like this, navigators work in teams.
We each have different experiences and we've seen different things. And so when we run into something we don't understand, we can bounce questions off each other.
Plagg went through many hours of training, including shadowing state navigators, before offering sessions at the library. So far, the partnership between the hospital and library has served more than 60 people. The library and hospital navigators have seen a range of reactions to what healthcare.gov has to offer. Some people are elated, but others, like Julie, are disappointed.
Well, if it's saying $210, there's no way.
Okay.
I could tell you that right now, just with my household expense. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You know, just basic living.
Plagg changes the settings to include other plans.
So this one is showing a monthly premium of $99.83 for a bronze plan through WinHealth.
But based on the plan's deductible and copay, Julie could end up paying more than $6,000 out of pocket if she has to have surgery or another expensive procedure. When it comes to making tough financial decisions, navigators are careful not to tell individuals what to do.
You know, we're not allowed to give advice on that.
Okay, well, that's a good question to ask.
It is, yes.
Instead, the three navigators in the study room walk Julie through her options in detail. They also make an appointment for her the following week to give her time to decide what to do. Under the Affordable Care Act, individuals have until March 31st to purchase health insurance, or they'll end up paying a penalty for going without. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Huntington in Jackson.
We're joined now by author Brock Coburn. He lives in Wilson, and his book, The Vast Unknown, is about America's first expedition up Mount Everest. Coburn spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden. He says many of the members of the expedition honed their climbing skills in Wyoming.
Well, the leader of the expedition, a Swiss-Austrian named Norman Dierenfurth, first climbed the Grand Teton in 1939 with the best-selling novelist at the time, best-selling writer James Ramsey Ullman. And so Norman knew that when he was selecting a team for Everest, that the Tetons, as the premier climbing venue in the United States, at least for rock climbing, the Tetons would really be the nursery and the playground where he should look for young, growing climbers.
Now, you talk about how this expedition, this first U.S. expedition to Everest, related to the political climate at the time, to the space race, to what America's role was in the world. What's the relationship there? How does Everest tie into all these things?
Well, the early 1960s were a time of great uncertainty in America. America wanted to establish itself as a player on the world stage. And in 1958, the Russians had launched a basketball-sized satellite named Sputnik. And America immediately became space crazy, and they wanted to adopt Sputniks of their own. But mainly they were afraid that America was falling behind in the space race. And that's what inspired President John F. Kennedy in 1961 to give his famous moon speech, in which he vowed that by the end of the decade, by the end of the 60s, America would put a man on the moon. And it was at the same time that we were wondering, well, if America could put a man on the moon, certainly they could put a human on top of the highest point on Earth. And the era of what was referred to as the ugly American was afoot at the time. And President Kennedy and the leader of the expedition wanted to reverse that questionable reputation and try to establish something more hopeful and inspirational and positive.
Well, and that's an interesting thing that you bring up, the concept of the ugly American, because certainly in your description of this expedition, this team, they, first of all, obviously hire a lot of locals as their support team and also provide quite a bit of medical assistance to people. Did that kind of help America's image?
I think it did. When the 1963 American Eversters trekked from Nepal's capital of Kathmandu, the 180 miles to base camp, they came across people in their evening medical clinics that they gave for free. At each night's camp, they treated people who had never been exposed to Western medicine or Western thinking. And many of these people were very grateful.
Now, this expedition was not just about mountaineering. It was not just about getting up to the top of Everest. There was also quite a bit of scientific research going on here. Why was that?
The team's leader, Norman Dierenfurth, knew that in order to raise the $400,000 that they would need for this expedition, they would need media, which they had on board in the form of the National Geographic Society and a film and magazine articles that were going to be made, and also science. And so a high-altitude physiologist, a sociologist, psychologist, glaciologist, and other scientific types were hired on to do some preliminary studies, some studies that had never been done in that part of the world. The glaciologists, for instance, found some of the earliest indications of glacial recession in the Himalayas and really established some of the baseline data that is now used in climate change studies.
And some of the psychological research that was done there, this was interesting because it had applications to the military, to space travel. Why was that?
Well, Dick Emerson in particular was wondering what the effect of isolation and hardship would be on Americans, because we were just entering the space race. Seamen were starting to go under the ocean in submarines for extended periods of time. And it wasn't known what would happen to men confined in isolation. And so he conducted a study during the expedition itself, and the results are still being referred to.
Is there any particular message that you hope readers will take away from this?
Well, I hope that young people especially remember the legacy of these climbers. They were not climbing for individual glory or achievement or attention. They were happy if only one member of their team were to reach the top. And so I felt that they really embodied what's been referred to as the brotherhood of the rope. They were in it together, and they engaged collaboration, cooperation, a lot of persistence and discipline and rigor, and a fair amount of compromise, too, while they handled the inevitable arguments that would break out. And they did it in a inspiring and a mature fashion that I hope that young people today especially will remember and recognize.
Brat Coburn is the author of The Vast Unknown, which is about the first U.S. expedition up Mount Everest. Thanks so much for joining us.
And thank you, Willa.
A bluegrass band with Wyoming connections will be holding its breath at the Grammy Awards on Sunday night. That's because Della May's recording Oft This World Can Be is up for Best Bluegrass Album. Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer reports.
Late last year, late at night, the band was on the road in Tennessee when they heard the news. Shelby Means, who plays bass and sings harmony, says the band was packed into a van with their sound man at the wheel.
And all of a sudden, Jenny Lynn just started screaming, and she has the highest, loudest scream out of all of us girls. And I was like, what, oh my God, you know, what's going on? Are you okay? And she said, I just got an email, Jim. Jim sent us an email and said that we were nominated for a Grammy. Congratulations on the Grammy nomination.
And the girls about ran off the road screaming, you know, in the van. So, yeah, it was just amazing. And they're still completely bowled over by that and completely modest about it.
Laramie musician Bill McKay has known Shelby Means since she was a kid, and he wrote the song that closes the album. He says the Grammy nomination capped off a very good year for Della May in 2013.
I mean, they were still giddy from the fact that they had Brian Sutton produce their album and had a rounder contract, you know. That was enough joy for them for 1 year, and then before you know it, they won the Emerging Artist of the Year at IBMA, and that was huge.
Della May was the idea of champion fiddler Kimber Ludeker. In 2009, she started gathering together some of her favorite players, mandolinist Jenny Lynn Gardner and guitarists Celia Woodsmith and Courtney Hartman. Hartman's from Colorado's Front Range and is another of what McKay calls his musical nieces.
Empire sits at the edge of a hill born out of a gypsy mind. Hell, there once 300 souls and none of them are mine. Now they're just ghosts in the street.
Shelby Means is the most recent addition to the band. She joined about a year ago, right before Oft This World Can Be, the band's second full-length album, was recorded. She was born in Lexington, Kentucky, which she says gives her some bluegrass cred. But she grew up in Laramie in a musical family, jamming with her dad and Bill McKay in the Big Hollow Bluegrass Band and playing in a band with her brother, Jacob. After graduating from the University of Wyoming, she made the plunge and moved to Nashville.
I'll be honest, I was a little nervous. She went off on this road trip with this kind of original quasi-rock and roll band, playing the some not very wholesome kind of joints, and you know, her mother was pretty panicked, and I wasn't sure, you know, but boy, when I saw that she toughed it out through that, it took a lot of gumption. for that kid to be in that band and stick it out.
The members of Della May have diverse backgrounds in various roots music, like bluegrass, old-time and Texas fiddle, and blues rock. Means says that's a strength.
We're proud of the fact that we all, you know, have these different backgrounds and can mix them together to create a unique sound that's fresh but also rooted in our tradition.
I am a child, I am a child, I am a child awaiting.
The making of Oft This World Can Be was certainly a rooted experience. It was recorded at the atmospheric Cash Cabin Studios, built by Johnny Cash.
And so we knew we were going into that really special place, and we felt the pressure to make something really cool.
The most intimate experience comes at the end of the album. The five women of Della May crowd around one microphone late at night to record a song written by Bill McKay, voices rising above the plucking of June Carter Cash's guitar.
I gave away all that I owned.
The vibes in the cabin were so crazy. It was really, it felt like June Carter might have been there with us.
The band's attention is already on a new album planned for release in 2015, but at the Grammy Awards on Sunday, Shelby Means and her colleagues from Della May will have a chance to reflect on how far they've already come. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Micah Schweitzer.
Coming up, we'll have a piece from our occasional series, Wyoming Stories, featuring an Iraq War veteran. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Irina Zhurov. An Improbable Pioneer is a collection of letters by Edith Sampson Holden Healy. Edith was from a prominent Boston family but moved to Wyoming in 1911 after she married a sheep rancher from the state. The letters describe daily life in Wyoming in the early 1900s. The book was edited by Edith's granddaughter, Kathy Healy, who's a writer and editor. It's the first imprint of the Washakie Museum's Legacy Collection, which is an initiative that hopes to encourage the preservation of family archives. Kathy started out by telling me how the project started.
I always knew about the letters, but I never thought much about them. And I really didn't start thinking about them very much until my father had been diagnosed with terminal bone marrow cancer. And I started looking for things that we needed to do before he died and projects that we could do together. And we had the letters. He found it very easy to read his mother's handwriting. I didn't find it as easy. And we had this idea, wow, let's transcribe the letters so that we have them in digital form. My father was very techie. We had the first ranch in the world. This is what IBM told him. The first ranch in the world to go digital. to get a computer. It was back in the mid-60s. So I can type very quickly. And we sat down in his office and we started to work. And he would read and I would type and I would ask questions. So at the end of that, all the letters were digitized. But once I got into it, we discovered more letters and made beautiful discoveries.
What was your grandmother like in person?
What I remember is I thought of her as quite glamorous. I was a middle grandchild, so I don't ever remember being told the rules by my grandmother, but I knew there were rules, and I absolutely obeyed them. When you played with the beautiful doll, that was a career girl doll. It wasn't one of those little fat baby dolls. It was a career girl doll with a beautiful wardrobe. You played with it very carefully, and then you put it away. And so, but I can remember sitting and watching her writing letters with her Neiman Marcus bed jacket on and her hair all done up and her makeup on. and drinking tea, and this was her work desk.
That does sound rather glamorous.
And when I would sit with my laptop in bed, writing away emails all over the world, I'd think, you're really like your grandmother. This is very strange. This is kind of a natural thing.
So many of the letters are just about everyday life in Wyoming in the early 1900s, yet they're also extraordinary for their time. And so I was wondering if you would read from a letter.
The Occidental Hotel, Buffalo, Wyoming, June 19th, 1911. Dear Mother, well, we've had a fine day. We started about 10 o'clock for the Simmons Ranch, which is the one beyond the Haley Ranch. We would get there about noon, and Alex said, of course, Mrs. Simmons would expect us to stay for dinner. But I don't like to drop in on people unexpectedly on a hot Monday, just at dinner time, even if it is the custom of the country. It was just 12:30 when we arrived there, and a Mrs. Oliver, who is keeping the ranch this summer, when she saw us turn in the gate, ran out in her sunbonnet and said, how do you do, Mr. Haley? Put your horses right in the corral, and Mrs. Haley, let me help you out. Come right back, Mr. Haley, because I'm just about to put dinner on the table. How's that for ranch hospitality? I learned later they hardly ever sit down to a meal that one or more don't drop in, mostly strangers, too. Now, you might wonder why Edith and Alec didn't get started until 10 o'clock in the morning. Her next paragraph explains, we had a fine time last night at Mrs. L's. It didn't get home until after 12. Had orange sherbet with whipped cream on top and angel cake. People stay so late at parties because there is no last car or train to catch. Must stop now as I am sleepy. Affectionately, ESH.
How did you decide which letters were worth including and any other editorial decisions that you were making as you compiled this?
It was actually quite a decision, and my editor and I spent time wrestling with it. And finally, it became a very easy decision. I put in all the letters we found. And the reason I did that is that this is a hybrid book. It's a book that I think people will enjoy reading who are not related, people who are researchers, people who love Western history. So it's a book that has interest, and at the same time, it's a family archive. And this is very important to me because I think that we finally have the technological tools that people can preserve their family archives. Not everyone has letters like we do. Our letters are pretty exceptional. But everyone has artifacts, and everyone has some photos, and everyone has family stories. And if you don't put these together and you don't record them, they're lost. You die and your kids remember a couple of the stories that you told. And they die and their kids remember maybe one of those stories. So if you want to save the stories, if you want to save tapestry of your own family's life, somebody has to start pulling it together.
This is the first imprint of the Washakie Museum's Legacy Collection. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us what the goal of the collection is?
To help people put together their family histories and to use the new technologies like print on demand so that you can put together books. They don't have to be like my book, but everyone can do a book, and it's not that complicated. All you have to do is get started, and that's one of the goals, is to help people start figuring out what they have and how they want to put it together.
Kathy Healy, thank you so much for taking some time to talk.
Irina, thank you for being interested.
And now an installment from our occasional series, Wyoming Stories. Jason Williams is an Iraq war veteran from Lander. In 2004, he was part of a Marine expeditionary unit sent to Najaf.
We were part of the 11th MEU, the Marine Expeditionary Unit. We offloaded in Kuwait, and then we flew into Iraq. The overall mission was that a guy by the name of Mutad al-Sadr raised a militia and was causing a lot of problems in the Najaf. And so they had us go in there and start clearing it out. I remember we were going into the city, and I ended up jumping out of the back end of the 7-ton and just posting security, just checking out the surrounding areas, making sure that nobody was going to try to ambush us or anything. And a kid that couldn't have been more than 8 years old came up. He started pointing at me, and then he pointed into town, and then he pointed back at me, And then he made a rifle gesture, and then he pointed back at me, and then he ran his thumb across his throat, and he pointed at me again. You know, he was basically telling me that if we go into town, we were all going to die. And I was just like, wow, this kid's 8 years old, and he's telling me already that I'm going to die. These kids already know what fighting is, what war is and stuff, and here I am, this naive 18-year-old. I'm a Marine, but I hadn't experienced war or anything yet. We got the order to keep going into Najaf, and I remember laying down behind the curb of this street, and I was looking out in this field because it was just a bunch of dirt, and I can remember just these little puffs of smoke coming up, or little puffs of dirt coming up. I thought, how peculiar, that's so weird, what is going on over there? You know, and I looked over to my side and I said, hey, do you see this? What's going on with all this little dirt puffs? And my team leader was just like, oh man, those are bullets, dude. You know, like, what do you think they are? I was like, oh. And I remember distinctly laughing and telling some of my buddies to watch my hand because it was shaking uncontrollably. I couldn't stop it from shaking. There was just so much adrenaline and I was just so scared. Even though I hadn't been engaged and I wasn't shooting back at anyone or anything, the threat was there. The idea that somebody was trying to kill you was actually all the more real. Yeah, it wasn't training anymore. We were actually doing it for our work. It was what we were paid to do. It was what we were trained to do. And now we were actually doing it. And so they drove a couple of the M1 A1 Abram tanks through these huge walls that was surrounding the cemetery because that's where they figured out that these guys were at. And so this cemetery is 3 miles by 5 miles long. And so we ended up going through these big, huge holes that these tanks had crashed through the walls so we could get into the cemetery and start clearing it out. And the cemetery was so big that you couldn't even see the guy to your left or to your right. You were kind of all alone. It was really, really scary. And they bury their dead on top of each other. And there's so many graves there that you would have to crawl over the graves to go forward. And so my friend and I, we were sitting behind these two graves and we were getting shot at. We didn't know where the fire was coming from, who was shooting at us and stuff like that. And so I was sitting with my back against one grave and he had his back against another grave. And we both ended up looking out in the same direction between these two graves to see if we could see anything. And probably the loudest snap I've ever heard in my life. It was like someone would take 2x4s and they were so elastic that they would whip them together. And if you can imagine those two boards colliding and then at the very end with the snap, that loud crack, that's what happened. Somebody had seen my friend and I and taken a shot at us and that bullet had passed right between both of our heads. And there's a big bullet hole, you know, right between both of our heads in this grave right behind us. And we both fell backwards and we were sitting there and we were just like, whoa, you know, you know, you kind of have to take a humorous approach to it because it's scary and it scared us to death. And so, you know, we were both sitting there laughing, you know, and I mean, that's probably not the best thing to do, but what else can you do?
That was Jason Williams talking about his experience in Najaf during the Iraq War. The piece was produced by Cordelia Zars with interviews recorded by Micah Schweitzer. Wyoming Stories is a Wyoming Public Media production. If you want to record your story, get in touch to set up an appointment. You can hear more Wyoming Stories on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, and you can find our podcast on iTunes.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear it again, listen to individual segments or listen to previous episodes, you can go to our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, and click on Open Spaces.
You can also submit ideas for future programs on that website and comment on our stories, and a reader is our web editor.
We also invite you to become a fan of our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page, and you can find all of our reporters on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.